WardenMartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy. WILL programming is made possible in part by the Little Theater on the Square in Sullivan, presenting Rave On from November 11th through 13th and 18th through 20th. Billy McKeegan steps on stage as music legend Buddy Holly, taking the audience back to the good old days of rock and roll with such rockin' in the aisle classics as That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, and Chantilly Lace. Ticket information at 1-888-261-9675.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. We're sorry that we're not going to be able to do the program that we had scheduled to talk about Sudan this morning with Dr. Ali Dinar from the University of Pennsylvania. He's the outreach director for the African Studies program there. We simply weren't able to connect with him. Occasionally this happens. I'm sure that we can reschedule this program, and we'll have this conversation for you on another day. Instead, we will reach into the archives of Focus 580 and bring out a program that we first broadcast in August of just this past year, a conversation with David Roediger, who's here on the faculty of the University of Illinois, talking about his book, Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White, The Strange Journey from Ellis Island to the Suburbs. As you listen, do keep in mind, this is an archive program, and in this hour of Focus, we will not take phone calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking about race in America. And while it might seem that at the outset that race is something that is very clear, there wouldn't be any argument as to who someone was, if you look at American history and look at some of the experiences of people who came to this country to live here, particularly at certain times in history, the idea of who people were was perhaps not so clear, particularly when it came to immigrants who were coming from Europe, for example, were coming at certain times after the country had been established, and there were people who were living here who thought of themselves as Americans, and they got to decide who else was going to be an American. Nowadays, we would look at someone who, for example, was Polish-American or Italian-American, and we would say, well, clearly that person is white. But there would have been a time when this was not quite so clear, and where their ethnicity, their racial status was more uncertain than we would understand today. And that gets at some of the work that our guest for this hour of Focus 580 has been doing for some time now. His name is David Roediger, and he's professor of history at the University of Illinois. Some of the ideas you will find in his new book, it's titled Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White. That is the subtitle. It's published by Basic Books. Follows an earlier book that looks at the same issues, but in a little bit earlier period of American history, that book titled Wages of Whiteness. Thank you for being here.
Thanks. I'm delighted to be here. This is a show I enjoy listening to a lot.
Just to begin, I think we need to talk in basic terms about whiteness and about this approach to race and who one is, because I think that perhaps some people will be scratching their heads a little bit at the very premise that there could be some doubt, or there, if not doubt, there could be some sort of some uncertainty as to a person's racial status, whereas today we would look at that as an issue that is being so clear that there's no point in even talking about it. When you use the term in your academic work and other people talk about whiteness, what exactly does that mean?
Well, on one level, it means who has the right to citizenship, to naturalized citizenship in the United States. So for these immigrants, on one level, being European, they were white. They could be, with certain exceptions, some Finns were challenged sometimes if they had left politics or some other liability. But in general, Europeans were white by law, as people sometimes put it, or white on arrival, as other people say. Mm-hmm. However, in daily life, whether you were considered white or non-white, or as I put it for the Eastern and Southern Europeans, as in-between people, it mattered what the judge thought of you. It mattered what the teacher thought of you. It mattered what the preacher thought of you. It mattered what the realtor, what the employer, all of those decisions were made from day to day. And the people who made those decisions didn't have ethnic as a word to resort to, or white ethnic as words to resort to describe these new immigrants coming in huge numbers from 1890 to 1924. And instead talked about these groups as races. So they might be the Slavic race or the Mediterranean races or the Polish race or the Jewish race, two Italian races, the southern inferior and the northern more white Italian race. So the language that we write about and think about as ethnicity was actually experienced as race. And part of the argument of the book is that then it turns out the whole story of U.S. history, at least from 1890 to 1945, is really much more a story of race than we had ever thought, mm-hmm. because it includes these new immigrant populations who are having their own race called into question and are figuring out what it means to live in the United States as a racial place.
Well, what at that time, what would have been the markers of one's identity as an American? For people who were making those definitions, if they were looking at someone and saying, this person clearly is an American, there's no hyphen, we're not concerned with their ethnicity, we think that they are something in a pure sense American with capital A. What would have been the markers of that status?
Well, the main marker, I think, I mean, there's a certain extent that color matters, for example. There's a certain extent that language matters. Teddy Roosevelt constantly talked about the English-speaking races. And by that, he included the Germans as one of the English-speaking races. He meant Northern and Western Europeans. But part of it was then to get Poles and others to learn the language quickly in order to fit in as an American. But the overarching criteria, I think, was fitness for citizenship, that if you were an American, you were fit. If you were a white American, if you were free white in 21, it was all about being fit to be part of the U.S. experiment in democracy and to be a citizen. And that wasn't all that clear for these Southern and Eastern European groups because their fitness was constantly being challenged. Not so much that the ones there couldn't be naturalized, but that there was going to be immigration restrictions. So there were constant debates about whether racially these groups fit in with the idea of an American democracy. And by and large, those groups lost those debates. By the 1920s, the Klan and the right wing and some sections of the progressives went over and said, no, we can't cope with this many millions of new immigrants coming. They used IQ tests. They used all the things that we think of as racial criteria to say, can't have Poles here, can't have Italians here, at least not in any kind of substantial numbers.
I guess I wonder to what extent that some things would have been important markers beyond the fact that a person had been born in the United States or perhaps their parents had been and their grandparents. You know, those people who could say, well, our family has been here in the United States for a long time.
Right.
But whether also things like property ownership, things like being a Protestant Christian, other sorts of things would have been the important things that a person would have pointed to, or wouldn't even have to point to, would have been very obvious to establish their fitness for citizenship.
Yeah, and I mean, people say Anglo-Saxon and Protestant, really Celtic was fine, but in general, the Klan, for example, in pushing for immigration restriction, very much focuses on religion. And then on the home ownership, property ownership one, a lot of the book turns on property mm-hmm. and on homes. And when I wrote this book, it was originally titled Getting Into the White House. And next to my computer the whole time was that title to remind me of what the book was about. And then the publisher said, no puns in titles ever. And so I lost the title and they said people would be confused and they think it was a real White House. But the book is about working, as the title suggests, but it's also very largely about new immigrants' desire to own property and what that meant in being included as white. And it really, at the very moment in the 20s that the Congress was saying, you're not racially good enough to be part of the United States, in localities, people were being brought into white property owners' associations. Eastern and Southern Europeans were being allowed to be in and lead these white associations to restrict neighborhoods to keep blacks and Mexicans out of those neighborhoods. So there's a real importance to home ownership that runs through many, many chapters in this book.
Mm-hmm. We have a caller. We'd welcome others. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Our guest with this part of Focus 580, David Roediger. He is professor of history here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. The book we're talking about is titled Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White. It is published by Basic Books, and it's just out recently. Certainly, you should be able to find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. We have a couple of callers here ready to go. We'll bring them in, starting with someone here in Champaign-Urbana, someone local, on line number one. Hello.
Hi, there's a story about the Southwest. The questioner said, when did you arrive in the States? And most of the people there said, in effect, the States came to us. So could you discuss, citizenship in various contexts, some places recognize anyone born as a citizen, and some require additional paperwork. You just can't claim citizenship being born there.
Yeah. Yeah, the Southwest is a really interesting example, and sometimes the students there put it that we didn't cross the border crossed mm-hmm. us. And in the period that I'm talking about, the book is not about Chicano history in general. It's about Eastern and Southern European immigrant history. But it turns out that those histories were very much mixed up and that there were a lot of Italians in the copper and other mining areas in the Southwest who kind of for a time identified as Latin races and felt that language-wise and appearance-wise and culture-wise and religion, they had more in common with Mexican workers than they did with so-called Anglo workers, so that some of the best soccer players on Mexican teams in some of the mining towns in Arizona were actually Italian kids. And it is a small example, but a nice example of how this idea that the system of race that we end up with wasn't really written in stone, that it had to develop and people had to make choices, and that there were sometimes other choices that people actually made on the ground.
Mm. This gets at a question that at some point I did want to raise and to talk about what is happening today and whether this is still happening today, particularly when you look at the large numbers of people who are coming from Latin America mm-hmm. to the United States, whether this is still an ongoing process.
Yeah. There is, of course, a big prediction industry in the United States that says in this year the United States will cease to be a white majority country. And it could be 2041 or 2050, but it constantly is said. And then the Latino population in particular, that boom is what's alluded to. But what interests me a lot in writing this book is that that same thing was happening in the 1890s as happened in the early 20th century, as happened in the 1990s and in our century. And people were saying the United States is about to lose its white American racial character. Well, they meant there were a lot of Poles and Italians and Jews and Greeks coming in. But somewhere along the line, the in-between status of those people became more firmly white. And they mm-hmm. learned the racial system in the United States, or their children and grandchildren did. So I think obviously there are some really interesting comparisons. I'm not a person who believes that history repeats itself. I think that every economy is different. Every political system moment is different. And so we get to kind of figure out what race is going to look like in the 21st century. And it's not predetermined that, say, Cubans are going to become white or the model minority of Asians are going to become white and will maintain a white majority in that way as happened in the 20th century. But I think that the historical work raises some really interesting questions. One of them is, who teaches these new immigrants about race in the United States? Jim Barrett, who's in my department, and I have worked a lot on how the Irish Americans who came earlier and often shared Catholicism with Eastern and Southern Europeans were the racial teachers in many ways of those new immigrant groups in the early 20th century. And so an interesting question for me now is where does racial knowledge come from? Where does learning about the U.S. racial system come from for people who are coming in? And given the spread of U.S. popular culture everywhere on the planet, what kind of racial assumptions and knowledge do people have before they come from video culture, from music, when they arrive in the United States?
Mm. Let's talk with someone here in Chicago. This is our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning. How you doing?
Yeah.
Good. I'd like to ask the professor two questions. One, the term race, I mean, I'm a black person born in the United States, been here forever in my whole roots. And, you know, I'm a part of the human race. You know, that's my first thing. And I'm not trying to be funny when I say that. But where does this term race comes from? And when they start talking about, you know, Hispanics, you know, they it's no difference. There's no difference between how they classify folks than we do here in the United States. You have black people from Spanish-speaking countries that are Hispanic. So what they do in the count, they just include all of them, you know, Minnie Minoso, George Orton, and all these guys, as being Hispanic, which they are. It's like we have black Americans, white Americans, and, you know, Native Americans, you know, other different kind of ethnic groups here. Would the proper term for race be ethnic, or where does this term race, where does it come from? And I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Well, that's an excellent question, and a lot of the first chapter of this book kind of tries to wrestle with the difference between race and ethnicity and how late a coming term ethnicity is in the United States. And one of the points that needs to be forcefully made is that, of course, race doesn't have an important biological existence. And one of the great triumphs of the 20th century was for science to show that, and for at least social science to begin to acknowledge that race is not an important thing as biology. It doesn't exist in, it doesn't get made in DNA in any significant kind of way. But our problem then is to try to explain a society in which, given that race is a fiction biologically, still African Americans have 1/7 of the family wealth, maybe now only 1/10 of the family wealth as so-called white Americans. African-American young men are 7 times as likely to be incarcerated as white Americans. So that race is this fiction, but it also is a fiction that has a academics use the fancy term social construction, but it's a social construction that has this weight in shaping what people's chances in life are. And so in a certain way, I resist saying, well, everything's ethnic, because the term ethnic came into being in World War II years in order to acknowledge that these new immigrants and their kids had become white. And it was a new term to avoid saying race, but only to avoid saying race in their case in general. And race was reserved then for the big, what people called the big races, like at that time, the yellow race and the black race particularly. And as hideous as that is as science, and as much as we wish for a world in which there's only a human race, as a description of how the society works in terms of inequality, that usage of the word race actually has some force. I was in South Africa during the liberation of South Africa, and the very best people there would say the way to non-racialism is through race. And it made me think a lot about how our impulse to say, let's just be done with this. It's a painful thing to talk about. Let's stop with the race talk already. Here was the place on the, in the world where people were thinking the hardest about how to overcome racial inequality. And they were clear about the fact that you couldn't just do that as much as you might like to by saying, okay, we're not going to use the word race anymore. Mm-hmm.
Other questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I realize maybe this is backtracking a little bit, but I want to ask this question. If you put yourself in the perspective of someone who would think of himself as, going back to this time that we're talking about, think of himself as American, one of these people who clearly would be white and Protestant probably, perhaps a property owner, perhaps somebody whose family had been here for a long time. And as they looked at these newcomers that we today would see also as white, Polish Americans, Italian Americans, the kind of people that we're talking about, as they looked at them, I'm interested in what constitutes this in-between status. And as they looked, as the white American elite looked at the person that we, the newcomer, the European American, that we also would see as white. What do they, in what way did they see that person as being different from them? What exactly were the important differences that they recognized?
Well, it would have started in childhood, and it would have started with, in some cases, the native-born Protestant American white. You didn't even have to say white. Toni Morrison points out that at that point, American implied white pretty strongly for most of the population. But their kids would have seen the new immigrant kids as without English, as ragged, and as having harrowing experiences in schools, except in some Catholic schools that were run by, say, orders of Polish nuns or harrowing language experiences, harrowing experiences with the mispronunciations and sometimes deliberately so of their names by teachers who were either Irish-American or who were WASPish Americans that you described. So it would have very much started in childhood. And in the first generation experiencing those school situations, a very few people managed to form interracial, in the sense of Eastern and Southern Europeans marrying with WASPs, marriages. By the second and third and fourth generations, this mounts up and you get people who are very hyphenated with lots of different ethnicities. And it becomes sensible for them to say, oh, we're white, rather than say we're five different things and to try to figure out which they mostly are. Another place that people would have seen that difference is at work. And a lot of the book is about work and about the fact that the wages, the compensation, the skill levels of these in-between immigrants were generally higher than African Americans and Mexican Americans, but significantly lower than those native-born that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And even in unions, a third of all unions before the CIO in the early 30s, a third of all unions forbade non-citizens from being members of the union. So they would get that lesson from seeing how their own union worked, that it was good to be a native-born American Protestant and a problem to be an immigrant.
Yeah. And just sort of to round that point out, it seems that you're making an argument that one of the forces that helped to make these people white ultimately was organized labor.
Yes. Yes, very much. And the New Deal, the whole New Deal, but particularly the industrial union organizing drive in the 1930s. That's the part of this book that's going to be the most controversial, because the reinterpretations of progressivism and immigration restriction are kind of within the universe of what people are arguing. But I'm wanting to see the New Deal as delivering full white Americanism to the children of new immigrants. And it did that through those new immigrants becoming the base for the new industrial unions and to some extent being the officers, the secondary leadership of those unions. And it also did it again through housing. Mm-hmm. The New Deal invents redlining and discrimination against black and Mexican neighborhoods and preferentially loans to white people. Mm. And it sort of forces new immigrant children, the children of new immigrants, to claim that white status if they want to claim a suburban house. One of the second subtitles is The Strange Journey from Ellis Island to the Suburbs, and that move to the suburbs, to the white-only suburbs, is the place, the physical place, where in-between status disappears and where people become much more fully white. And it's important that it's a state-subsidized move, that the New Deal, the Federal Housing Administration, the VA eventually creates and subsidizes these all-white enclaves. Mm-hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is David Roediger. He's professor of history here at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. His book is Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White. It's published by Basic Books and is out just now. If you'd like to read the book, go to the bookstore and take a look at it. Also here on the program, as always, we welcome questions and comments. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Chicago, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I thought it's very interesting how you said that race is biological fiction, because at this present time, the medical profession more than ever. At the same time, they're going through and identifying allele by allele in the DNA. They are producing products and drugs for quote-unquote blacks only. And it seems to me almost as if the medical profession is trying to cling to a biological definition of blackness at the same time it's being disproved, which is very strange since it's unscientific. And I'm wondering if you'd ever discussed how important blackness is to whiteness, that without identifiable black race, there would be no white race and the company privileges, white privileges. And what does it say about our time today that as more and more there is no biological reason to maintain the fiction of race, that it's very important, it's so important that our medical community is ready to discredit itself to maintain this fiction of race?
Thank you. I like both of those questions a lot. And the first one on medicine, rather than claim any expertise that I don't have, I really want to recommend Google searchers to try Troy Duster's work. Troy is a Chicagoan who taught most of his life at California Berkeley and was involved with the Human Genome Project as a social scientist, and is writing really, really penetrating things about the ways that small genetic markers do follow race, so-called. But, of course, there's much more variation, for example, among Ethiopians than there is across racial lines genetically. So he makes the point that we can have some kind of subtle science about some of these markers, maybe, without buying into the ideas that there are important racial differences. And I think that Troy makes that more directly and better than almost anybody. On the point about blackness and whiteness, I actually teach in an African American studies program here as well as in history. My appointment's half and half, and my training is in African American studies. And very much when I did this book, I was struck by how much I just went back and reread African American studies, because the people who were really trying to understand how race mattered to new immigrants were not really immigration historians through most of the 20th century. They were African American writers. Morrison, profoundly, in her essays, most importantly, James Baldwin, in a huge book called The Price of the Ticket, that collects his essays. And the price of the ticket for Baldwin was to, for these new immigrant groups, was to become white Americans and to give up on vibrant national cultures that they have in exchange for a kind of empty culture, but political and economic privilege. So not, I take the point about blackness being a touchstone and Asian exclusion being a touchstone and Native peoples and stereotyping in that regard, we see it here, being touchstones for how whiteness gets created. But I just add to it that blackness is also important because it helped create the intellectual tradition which considered this a problem and made people wonder, what was it that made people Baldwin has this line where he says, nobody sat around in Norway bragging about how white they were. So he wants to understand what's the process by which this becomes important in the United States and how are people learning. He describes people, new immigrants, as being trapped in a whiteness factory.
And yes, but you're talking, you're switching back and forth between the biological definition of race and race as a social construct, which I would agree with is important. But the thing is that the main problem in our society is that we are persistently, in many subtle ways, and especially the medical profession, continuing to push the biological definition of race. And I think it's really important always to be very clear what you're talking about, because as long as you push, or at least by not defining when you're not talking about this biological fiction, people will continue to think, because of the level of education in our society, that race is a biological factor, and therefore many of our social problems will not be dealt with because we attribute them to biological and therefore beyond human control.
It's an interesting point, and I think it goes back to the point about the human race that the other Chicago caller raised earlier. It's, you know, we end up discussing things in terms of race, and we, you know, some people always put quotation marks around it. In South Africa, people often say so-called, and I sometimes, you've heard me on this program, say so-called in front of race, so-called white. But sometimes on university campuses, we believe that we've won battles about anti-black racism and biology. And then all of a sudden, the bell curve comes along and sells 900,000 copies and doesn't get sort of laughed out of court, even among academics. And as you say, it's the medical profession that's a locus of this now. So even on the campuses, I think there's a question about whether we've won that battle. And I like your insistence that we keep fighting that battle.
Oh, I think it's absolutely necessary because the simple fact is, for African Americans, if there's a persistence in this, we'll pay the price because we're getting voodoo science and voodoo medicine as a result of this. And because of the problems of economics, we are the least able to afford having poor science and poor medical practices practice on us. Thank you for your comment. Well,
thanks for the call. Let me raise a different sort of question, going back to this notion of whiteness as a social construct and how it is that people who, when they first came to this country, would not have been considered to be fully white or fully American by the white American elite became white. And in, as we have discussed in the book, you argue that there were two paths that really made that change possible, made their becoming white possible. And we've talked a little bit about them. One being the workplace and organizing people into unions, and the other being home ownership. And I'm interested particularly in the second, but maybe there is a way in which government, sort of deliberate government policy, facilitated that transition to help these people become white.
Yeah, I think it's very clear in the case of home ownership. As I said, the Homeowners Loan Corporation and then the FHA and the VA, and this is not my contribution. It's other George Lipsitz and others who have argued this for years, that if we look at this wealth differential, 7 to 10 times wealth differential in favor of whites over African Americans, for example, a lot of it is explained by inheritance of home ownership and rise in home values and the relative rate of home ownership. And that goes straight back to government subsidies that went particularly to white veterans and particularly to white home buyers in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and in many ways right up in the way that the real estate industry works. But also where labor is concerned, the New Deal labor policies created laws that defined the workers to be covered, the citizen worker, as I put it, to be fully a citizen and fully a worker, as not including domestics and not including agricultural workers. So the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Social Security Act, overwhelmingly covered Eastern and Southern European workers who were factory workers and dock workers and construction workers and their kids. And it overwhelmingly excluded Mexican and black workers who were concentrated in those sectors. And sometimes that was explicitly said. I mean, there, and the Wagner Act, the Labor Relations Act in the 30s, there was a fair chance that the NAACP was agitating to make racism by unions against the law, so that it could have been an unfair labor practice in and of itself under the Wagner Act. And the Roosevelt administration capitulated on that as well. So it's usually acknowledged that New Deal housing policy was a pro-white policy, but I think people don't see how deeply implicated the New Deal was in labor policies, which were also drawing this distinction between who the full citizen workers are and who are left out of Social Security, Who's left out? You know, over time that changed and the programs became more inclusive. But the laws originally were underlining that there's a difference between Southern and Eastern Europeans and blacks and Mexicans.
Let's talk with some other people who are listening here. Peoria is next in line. Line number one. Hello.
Yeah, just quickly, because you said a lot that I had to try to digest. I had a scenario that, you know, I grew up in the 60s and 70s where affirmative action and, you know, just to be able to walk down the street as a normal human being, only to find that now when I walk down the street, Hispanics would look over at me like I don't belong. And so I become a third-class citizen now. So that, you know, there was a time when children between blacks and whites frowned upon, and yet you see many of such children now. But I wanted to hear your point on if you had a child between a Spanish or Hispanic and a white and Hispanic and a black, or even a child between a white and a black, which child would be shown preference? Mm. And I'll listen for your comments.
Mm-hmm. The comment raises a kind of a big historical problem with looking at Latino immigration, Puerto Ricans in some places mainly, and Mexicans in other places mainly. Because there were, as I said, times and places where it seemed like those groups would fit in as white. There were more times and places where it seemed like they'd have affinities for at least a while with Italians and other Portuguese immigrants, for example. And then there was the end result, which was that there was this pretty firm separation between those races. But where blacks and Spanish-speaking immigrants are concerned, and again, the racial language is, you know, some of the immigrants were themselves black. So I want to keep that point clear. But where those relations were concerned, the caller's comment is really interesting because there was a certain tendency for African-American civil rights activists, freedom fighters, to want sometimes to talk about Americanness in a way that their own longstanding presence and labor in the country would be acknowledged. And so there was a feeling that these new groups, particularly Polish and Italian and Jewish groups, were jumping over people who had been Americans for 200, 300 years. So that it was, in a way, the new immigrants wanted to talk about whiteness to establish their Americanness. And African-American leaders sometimes wanted to talk about Americanness and longstanding presence in the United States in order to do that. And some of that, you know, even in Chicago now, some of the ways that Puerto Ricans and Mexican immigrants relate to each other is again through this lens of who's more American, who's more longstanding, who has more of a record of military service. But there also always was a tradition, and Du Bois, the great black intellectual, was the embodiment of this tradition in the 1920s, of trying to bring all these groups together. And for a while, he was also trying to bring Eastern and Southern Europeans, and particularly Jews, into this coalition to fight against what he called Nordic whiteness, to fight against the real commanding positions in the culture and in the economy. So there are both these tensions and these traditions of unity.
I want to thank the caller. We are moving into our last 15 minutes. I have a couple of other people I want to bring into the conversation and also introduce again our guest. We're talking this morning with David Roediger. He's professor of history here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. His book is Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White, The Strange Journey from Ellis Island to the Suburbs. It's published by Basic Books and is out just recently. Questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is in Urbana, here where we are, line number two. Hello.
Hi. Two callers ago, a woman called in and was talking about medical voodoo science. And I realized that she had called in, she, like I am, as a frequent caller, so I recognized her voice, is concerned about a recent approval of a medication specifically for African Americans to combat heart failure. And I've seen in various articles concern that this is saying that there are racial differences medically. And I understand that. And I have a friend, a very dear friend, who died a year ago prematurely at the age of 62 of heart failure and is an African American. So I've sort of been keeping my eyes open for what's really going on here. And I know this is not historical, but it's a current issue now for African Americans who are paying attention to this and for the medical profession. And I just wanted to say that I've teased out, just happened to run across little bits of pieces of information I'd like to share. And one is that obviously race is a pretty gross, as in too broad a category. I would guess that most African Americans in this country have mixed racial heritage. Even so, there's also a social aspect to health, which includes things like foods that we see as comfort foods and that are passed down as things that we tend to eat. So I don't know where this health issue comes from, but I did have read that African Americans tend to have a lower level of nitric oxide in their blood, and of course this is, again, a gross description because obviously not every African American is the same, but also that nitric oxide is influential in heart failure and it has an effect on relaxing the blood vessels. I haven't seen why this is happening, why you tend to see a lower level in African Americans, but African Americans do suffer disproportionately with diabetes and heart failure, apparently. And this medication was also approved because the company teased this out from a larger study and was able to get a patent on this particular use of the drug where they couldn't get a patent before because it's a matter of deadlines and so forth. I'm not explaining this very well. But I just wanted to share that information. It's not complete, but I think that when we start, we have to be concerned about people making assumptions with regard to race and treating medicating people and treating. But it's also quite real that there are some things that are small genetic differences or differences in lifestyle that can contribute to health. African Americans are more likely to have sickle cell anemia, for instance. Ashkenazi Jews have a whole series of genetic defects that are a real concern in terms of survival of children. That don't happen to everybody, but they are more likely to be in those populations. So I think we need to look at things very carefully when we're talking about medicine and racial issues. I don't know if I could say more, but I think that's about all I can come up with intelligently.
All right. Well, and maybe it's something we should think about doing some programs on, too.
Yeah.
We'll see. I don't know. You want to comment?
I just want to recommend Troy Duster's work yet again. He talks explicitly about a lot of these issues and particularly wants to think about not only lifestyle but stress and experience and poverty and what leads to heart disease among African Americans as environmental, experiential factors. But he also wants to retain an ability to have targeted campaigns in certain communities about fatty foods and to acknowledge some sense that race matters in the way that people confront the health system and confront health problems. So I think it's a work of tremendous, tremendous balance, and I really strongly recommend it.
All right, I thank the caller. Let's continue, and we'll talk with someone else next. This is someone in Indiana. Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
These may be rather confusing because I just started thinking about these things since you came on and raised some issues. I was going to mention the sickle cell anemia myself. Unfortunately, it looks like it's going to have to be done in a multivariant way because of all the differences with the different groups. I was, you know, just a quick footnote. I was wondering if certain groups in Africa also, you know, have a preponderance for having sickle cell anemia, or whether it's just something that's been discovered in this country. But my real question was this. I remember as a youngster, I was going over how I was taught, and I'm in an area in Indiana where a lot of immigrants ended up working with Pennsylvania Railroad, so we had a large slew of groupings, and I remember being told that person was a Dago, that person was a WOP, and things like that. And the only things that were clear to me as a youngster was is that the skin coloration, and that made some sense to me then, since, you know, categorizing people, it unfortunately didn't work out the way the whites that were trying to tell me this, that was, you know, what I should do, because I ended up being having some very close friends that were African-American, and, you know, and since now I really miss them, because we really got along quite well. Then I started thinking about, what about, if I'm not being too general here, what about areas where the group skin color is closer? And I started thinking about the Japanese treatment of the Chinese and the North and South Koreans, as far as that goes, where the subtleties between skin color are much, you know, at least to me as a white person, are, you know, not there at all. So I was wondering what kind of subtleties other groups who choose to practice apartheid in some form or another find about those people, or is it just simply they're from that country? I was wondering if anything had been done on that. And the man's name you're talking about from Chicago, is it Duster? My radio is not the best.
Yes, it's Duster.
D-U-S-T-E-R?
T-E-R, yes.
Okay, thanks. Because I'd like to look at that, because in some sense, and this may be, you know, a statement that I can't stand by after some, you know, evaluation, but it seems to me that the finding different groups within the human race, quote-unquote, that have particular preponderance for one disease or another doesn't seem to bother me whatsoever, even bringing in the social aspect of it, you know, whether it's the foods or the treatment through stress and stuff like that. The reason I brought up the multivariance kind of thing is that, you know, to me it's all one big group. And some, for one reason or another, you know, it could have been something back on, you know, it happened on the steppes or the, you know, the plains of Africa got started with, you know, some insect may have, you know, changed things in the genome for all I know. But those things don't seem to, they don't bother me as much, but, you know, I don't have to worry about too much about being discriminated against. So that's a possibility there that I, you know, always have in my back pocket that, you know, just shut up and wait till what history has to say about all this. But I was wondering if you'd done anything in that, were the groups, you know, within each other who discriminate against each other, or what subtleties they looking at to, you know, to give some sort of truthfulness to their position. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, let me just make a couple quick comments about that. Robert Orsi, the great anthropologist of Italian Americans, has this piece on Italian Harlem in which he argues that the proximity of Puerto Ricans to Italians made for a necessity for Italians to draw a very firm line against the Puerto Ricans, and actually says because people looked so alike, they end up making this point harder. And in there, one of the parishes that he does ethnographic work in could accept Haitian Catholics but could not accept Puerto Rican Catholics at its festas. And his argument is that the Haitians were sufficiently different that there was no racial threat of being misidentified as Haitian, but there was with Puerto Ricans. The other one that I love is the question of what happens if we take this out into the world and look at Chinese and Japanese and look at Australia and look at other places. I think that that's really one of the challenges for scholars and activists, is to think about how race works in the world and gets defined in different ways in different places. My Wages of Whiteness book that David mentioned is just being translated into Japanese. It comes out in a couple months in Japanese. And the translator's first query was, he had gotten to the word whiteness, and he said, what does this actually mean? And there was no Japanese equivalent to that quickly in the title. There was a problem.
Let's get one more caller here, at least. Gibson City. Line one. Hello.
Yes, hello. Yes, I have a couple questions. First of all, I'm from Native American background, so do you deal at all with Native American issues? And second of all, I've been looking up my maternal grandmother, and my including my mother's family, because I wasn't sure how many had come from the reservation, how many children. And I don't know if you know anything about this, but there, my mother was there's how many, you know, 0.5% of Native American. And she was 0.5%, but there was a couple of her sisters that were 0.25%. And I don't know if you know anything about that. And then thirdly, I just have a comment. My mother-in-law, who's retired lab tech, said the only two races are the male and female, because working in the lab, you could never tell by blood, you know, what race you were. It was more if you're male or female. And I'll just hang up and listen, and I hope to read your book. Thank you.
Thanks a lot. There's actually a strain of racist science in the early 20th century that defined all women as an inferior race. So there was some kind of recognition of the way that race and gender played against each other. Native Americans are important in the book at certain junctures, particularly in the 1920s, because the 20s are such a period of in which every racial group is being attacked in the United States, but they're all being attacked in different ways. So I'm trying to think about why, given all these attacks and given Du Bois's effort to bring people together, they couldn't come together because the methods of attack and the specific issues were so different. And for Native Americans, that period was very different because it was a period where other people were being denied citizenship. And in certain ways, Native Americans were being forced, coerced, cajoled into citizenship because the U.S. state thought that that was a better way to control reservations. So, yes, there's material about Native Americans in the book.
We're going to have to stop with more that could be said and probably a few topics for future conversations. But at this point, in this hour, we'll have to stop. And I want to say that if you'd like to explore these ideas further, you'd look for the book that our guest David Roediger has written. It's just out. It's titled Working Toward Whiteness, How America's Immigrants Became White, and it's published by Basic Books. David Roediger is professor of history here at University of Illinois. Thank you.
Thanks again for having me.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. We first broadcast the show August 17th. We will reschedule the program that we had in for this hour. We will talk, we hope, within the next couple of weeks with Dr. Ali Dinar from University of Pennsylvania about Darfur and Sudan. Our show made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. The broadcast also made possible by a grant from Strawberry Fields in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields Catering Department now offers boxed lunches for professional meetings or casual lunchtime gatherings. Strawberry Fields, 328-1655. That's it for us. Up next.